Mad Max Kodachrome, in honor of Baby Driver and the only living boy in New York, what Simon and Garfunkel song should be a summer movie next year?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the 57th Street Bridge song, a.k.a. Feeling Groovy, because it just has a nice vibe to it, and I would like a movie that's about it being the morning and you having no deeds to do and no promises to keep.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going to say Cecilia. It should be about Cecilia as per the lyrics of the song, and they should cast Zendaya or something. Some sort of cool ethnic actress from the Disney Channel I'm unaware of.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright, which I'm imagining as like an adaptation-style movie that's both about Frank Lloyd Wright and the breakup of Simon and Garfunkel all at once. And Nick Cage could probably play both of them.
Man, for all the people who thought we were still young, we knew so many Simon and Garfunkel songs just off the top of the head.
Hey-o!
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 171 for Tuesday, June 27th. And on this day in 1973, Live and Let Die, starring Roger Moore as James Bond, was released. Guys, I've never seen this Bond. How's it hold up?
You've never seen Live and Let Die?
No, man. My Bond knowledge is pretty thin.
Can you at least sing the song Live or Let Die?
Is that? Oh, yeah, I guess it is from that. I can sing the chorus. No, I can do the da-na-na, da-na-na.
Yeah, it's Paul.
That's the only part anybody cares about.
For sure.
Live or let die.
The book is really racist, and maybe this is a case where I would say maybe don't do the book and just do the movie, because Roger Moore James Bond movies are great.
All right. Good to know. We are still without David. He, I believe, is currently at the hotel from Lost in Translation per his Instagram. So he seems to be doing pretty well for himself. And I'm starting to wonder if David's absence is why our reviews have been falling off. We don't have any new reviews in the U.S. store this week.
Why would it be because of David?
I don't know. David, it's a correlation. I'm not saying it's causation.
Riles people up? Well, we had one last week that would theoretically be the remnants of David. I'm not attributing that harsh review to David. But
he's not gone forever.
We've also, I mean, maybe what we need to call on people to do here is spread the gospel of this podcast, not just leave a kind review, which people
That's
have done.
True.
But, I mean, we really have to get friends on board.
Yeah.
Family that you still speak to.
The family you're not fighting about healthcare on Facebook with?
Yeah. The nice guys.
And what if your uncles listen to this podcast, Patches?
They probably do, or I hope they do. That would be another, if you're my uncles listening to this, leave a review.
Man, if you're a member of my family and you're listening to this, I am stunned and shocked, so please leave me a review and tell me, because I don't think any of you are listening.
This podcast is for both fans and critics. Be a critic. Leave a review.
Yeah, your ongoing Twitter joke is very popular, so maybe you can use that to our advantage to get some reviews. Anyway, leave a review. Makes us happy. It'll make you happy. It feels good.
So long, Frank Lloyd Wright. I can't believe your song is gone so soon. I barely learned the tune so soon, so soon.
So this past Friday, Netflix released yet another brand new original series. Remember when Netflix original series used to come like every couple months and it was like an event and they didn't just literally come every weekend?
Yeah, they're like time to binge instead of like, here are the 89 things added to Netflix since you last signed in.
You are never leaving your house.
I now binge going outside and binge talking to friends as opposed to
Yeah, you have to do it all in one burst and then you go back to your Netflix habits.
Yeah, I plug back in.
So the series in question is called Glow. I watched it because Patches asked me to, because he was interested in it, to talk about for this podcast. But I think it's gotten a lot of hype. I think even for a Netflix show, people are paying attention to the show. It's shepherded in some way by Jinji Kohan of Orange is the New Black. I guess she's an executive producer. She's not the creator of the series. And it stars Alison Brie, and it's about this real women's wrestling league that was on like 80s cable. When I first started watching the pilot episode, I said, oh, of course, it's like a league of their own, but about wrestling. It's the same kind of like, let's start our own sports league ladies with our slightly sexist manager vibe to it. And I enjoyed it for that. I've watched two episodes. I really kind of liked the kind of underdog vibe to it. I think Alison Brie is really appealing, even if it makes no sense that a lot of the show is people telling her she's not pretty because she's Alison Brie.
Oh my God.
She's pretty. It's insane. I mean, it's scrappy kind of in the way that its characters are, even though, you know, it's got all the weight of Netflix behind it. I fell out of Orange is the New Black a long time ago, so I can't really compare it to where that show is right now. But I kind of like it as just, you know, another show with this large female cast doing pretty fascinating things.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Is this show good? Is it totally recommendable? Or is it like just another Netflix show that has a good
what
cast
does just
and a good
another
budget?
Netflix? Yeah, what does
well,
that mean?
Like you were making fun of this kind of onslaught of Netflix shows, and there's always one to talk about, but maybe
but
there are
all
three
very
or four
different
that I think are great. They're all very different, but this is like, again, this is a pretty high concept. You don't have a lot of like the makings, at least for me, when I watch even a season of a show that I really dig, I'm like, is this classic television or is this just, this is a movie that's been broken up into pieces so that Netflix can have this kind of cable reputation? Well, for me, Glow is actually, so I'm six episodes in. And Katie, before the podcast, I told you that I hated it and that I wanted you to watch it so that I could get another opinion. Because I felt, for a number of reasons, I'm like, well, this is about female experience and character, female bonding, and these characters who are living in the man's world. It takes place in the 80s, and Alison Brie's character Ruth is a struggling actress who's constantly like misreading her sides during auditions because she prefers the male part and all she wants to do is have a meaty part, and she's constantly playing secretaries, or not even, she can't get a job, but if she could get a job, she'd be playing secretaries, or she'd be on a soap like her best friend Debbie, who is also a big character who joins the Glow team. The parts are just bad, and they're living in a man's world and they hate it, and they kind of seek refuge in the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. And so for that reason, I was like, you know, I don't want to judge this too harshly because I may be removed from what some of the points of connection for women viewers or whatever. But I was also really down on these first few episodes because they take so long to get going. They're not very funny. Alison Brie, as you mentioned, seems kind of miscast because here's a character who's supposed to be like really plain and kind of uncastable, but she's totally castable. Alison Brie's a great actress, and she's very funny as the show gets going, but in these beginning episodes, it's such a slog. And Marc Maron plays Sam Sylvia, who is kind of the, as you mentioned, misogynistic, gross, coke-sniffing. It's kind of like a Boogie Nights-type character, but for the 80s.
But like
manager.
More pathetic than Boogie Nights, which is saying something.
Yeah, he's playing like a low rent Hollywood director type who has hit rock bottom with directing B movies or Z movies and is now turning to directing wrestling on television. And he's not good even throughout the episodes. And I'm going to reveal soon that I'm kind of digging it now, five or six episodes in. But throughout, Marc Maron seems like he's in a different universe than everyone else. He has this kind of comedian's rhythm where he, you know, everyone else seems like they have a script and he's just kind of riffing. It's a very bizarre disconnect for the rest of the show. So it keeps going and going, and it's like, why isn't this a movie? Why isn't this a great idea? Why isn't it the new League of Their Own? Because that's the blueprints for this show. That's the kind of dynamics between all these characters, the motley crew of wrestling women from all, you know, none of them know how to wrestle. Some of them are actresses and some of them are just kind of weirdos off the street who need a gig. And it's an interesting mashup. And as they get going, they have to bunk together, they have to train together, and they become good friends. But it takes so long to get going. And it's just, I hate being the person who says, get through those first few episodes, get to episode 6, and it really starts clicking because, I mean, it's a half an hour television show, but that's a lot of television to get through.
May I remind you that 2 months ago we had a conversation about Girl Boss in which you said literally exactly that.
Oh, I know. I don't like being that person then, and I don't like you being that person now, but this show
is... You mean Netflix's now-canceled Girl Boss?
I know. Well, we should talk about Girl Boss because Girl Boss is different for me.
Well, hang on. I feel like we're not done with Glow.
Yeah.
I mean, I did not feel like the first two episodes were a slog. I enjoyed them. I was excited to tune in for them again. And, I mean, I think the answer to the question of why this isn't a movie like A League of Their Own, I mean, you know the answer, is that they don't make movies like A League of Their Own anymore. They are now TV shows, and it's the format where these kind of mid-budget entertainments for adults have gone. And also, I think A League of Their Own would have been a great TV show. Like, if it had existed at a time when it could have been, I think it would have been perfect as this Glow kind of Netflix series. And, you know, having only watched 2 episodes, I'm not as far in as you are. I'm excited that I get to spend more time with these characters and get to know them in a way that I would have watched a whole episode of TV about Marla Hooch in A League of Their Own. I think it fits the whole concept of you enter a world full of all these interesting characters with all these rules of its own, and you explore it. And I see how it works as a single season of television, and not having seen the end of this one, I can still see how it would be a second season.
Just to be clear, A League of Their Own was a television show.
Oh, that's right. It was. In the early 90s.
Yeah.
So, good on you guys for having the idea.
Well, I think...
But I also think I also don't like Marc Maron. Just
oh, okay, good.
I'm with you there.
I think my problem with Glow is that, and it's similar to Orange is the New Black, there's a better story to tell here. There's a more interesting way to tell it, and I've fallen for the character played by this actress Brittany Young, who is like a heavy set person of color who she is like in her mid-20s. And she is supposed to be the like legacy descendant of this big professional wrestler. She plays Carmen Machu Picchu Wade on Glow. And she's so lovable and really funny, and she knows what she's doing. But she is obviously an outcast in the world that she comes from because she is a woman, and all of her dad and her brothers are wrestlers, and they are not. Her dad literally tells her at one point in the series, go get find a husband and get out of the ring because you don't belong here. And of course, compared to all these scrawny ass women, like Alyssa Brie, she's also a outcast. So it's like, she has a really interesting conflict. Why can't the show be about this? Why is Orange the New Black about a boring white woman entering this diverse world and slowly but surely veering away from her as the most interesting point or the entryway to the story? Why can't we get somewhere more interesting right away? Why can't Glow start with someone other than Alison Brie, or at least someone more realistic than Alison Brie? As funny as she is, throughout the series, she is trying to find her persona. It's actually the point of Glow is that she has no identity because everyone else can use what's interesting about them to create a wrestling persona. And Alison Brie has to struggle and struggle to find what she should be, other than a home wrecker, as they say. She sleeps with her best friend's husband, and that's kind of an inciting incident for all the craziness. But she ends up taking kind of like a Russian persona, and it's just so – it doesn't fit. It's not interesting, but you have a lot of interesting characters who never get to be characters. What gives?
I don't know, man. I haven't watched that far. I mean, I think there is a value in having the outsider in the world to introduce you to something. You know, you have Peggy Olson in Mad Men to kind of introduce you to the world of advertising. I'm not saying that means it has to be a pretty white girl. I think that's probably as much of, you know, Hollywood casting and finding someone like Alison Brie, who's a recognizable name to get you to pay attention, as anything else. But it didn't, I don't know. I think if you get into the other characters enough, as Orange is the New Black has done, like, no one watches Orange is the New Black for Piper. Like, they watch it for everything else.
But that's why wouldn't you watch it for Piper? Piper's like ostensibly the main character of Orange is the New Black. But
my understanding is that she's not really anymore the way that the show has developed. But again, I checked out of it a while ago.
Dave, how have you kept up with Orange is the New Black?
I haven't, but this is the seeds of another one of our arguments that we've had on Twitter and resolved to someday bring to the podcast, which is that if you don't watch a full season of television, that's your failing at this point as a viewer, because these things are, like Katie's saying, like movie-long things made into television.
But they're not movie-long. They're not movie-long.
Sure they are. Okay, so like, if you're saying that...
How is a five-hour television series movie long? Sorry.
If you're you know, comparing Glow and Girl Boss to something that needs to take a few episodes to get into, isn't that, like, ostensibly saying you need to hold on and figure out what this thing is, and that might require dedication of more than a few episodes?
Well, that's what I wanted to say about Girl Boss. What I thought was interesting about Girl Boss is that each episode felt like it had a beginning, middle, and end, and that there was an arc to get through, and even though the character was caustic and she wasn't resolved at the end of each episode, but the plots of each episode had momentum and finale. And I think that made Girl Boss a better show, even though it rubbed people the wrong way, and also had a strong take on that kind of angry, bristling character. Whereas Glow, it feels like it's just building a series and building likability on the same old, same old. These dynamics feel very pedestrian to me and obvious, and while heartwarming and easy to latch onto, not very complicated. I mean, none of the characters seem deep or feel like they have a walk of life other than I'm this label, I'm this label, I'm this label, which is funny because Glow, the criticisms against the actual Glow wrestling show and the criticisms that this show confronts is about stereotyping people so that they can easily be thrown in a ring and made into television, even though that's kind of what Glow, the Netflix series, is doing to these women. They don't feel that interesting, and it doesn't seem like it's taking risk, and especially with the 80s aesthetic and the music. Oh, it's just chock full of 80s songs, which, look, I like 80s music, and they're toe tappers, they're earworms, I like them, but it's so manipulative in a way that's frustrating to me, whereas the, like, 2007 pop culture of Girl Boss only laid into the, like, super specificity of that character and her tunnel vision of being this caustic individual. And I thought each episode rang true and had somewhere it was going each time. Whereas Glow, it's kind of just like, here's another bingeable episode and we're moving forward slowly but surely, and there's just enough comfort there to get you through it. I'm just a little disappointed, but I have to say by episode 6, I kind of dug it. So if you just keep going, I guess Netflix eventually convinces you that what you're watching is good.
Hey, at least the 80s nostalgia is not the same Amblin bullshit 80s nostalgia that's infected everything else.
That is true. That is true. It is not,
it's not,
this is not the creation
movie
of
about
men.
Children.
This is definitely not the creation of men. It's criticizing the creation of men with Glow, the original show. But I don't know. There's still, it's, Katie, I have to ask you this as we wrap up. There's a lot of nudity in this series. There was in Orange and the New Black, too. I also haven't watched, like, the last two seasons, so I'm not sure it's kept that up. But, like, Alison Brie has some sex scenes, and it seems like every woman in the show is going to take off her shirt and show her breasts at some point. And I thought that was kind of, I just thought that was kind of peculiar. I know it's real life, you know, everyone gets naked. And if you're in a changing room with another woman, you might get naked. But, like, I don't know, it's kind of weird. My prude?
I mean, I don't know. My best idea is it's a show about bodies and power, and then showing bodies in that context is maybe part of it. I don't know.
Yeah, you might be right. You might be right. That's not
there
something
I am,
I'm really down
about
on.
A show I
just thought
I haven't
that was
finished, even though you told me I have to like it.
Well, there you go. Glow, it's on Netflix. You can finish it whatever you fucking want.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Robots in disguise.
Oh, what are we talking about?
So, what? Okay, I was going to tell you what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, what are we talking about?
So, Transformers, guys, has not done very well in the American box office. As a matter of fact, it's the lowest opening the Transformers have ever had in America. Looking it up right now just to make sure I have my numbers in line. We're at $68 million right now. Very low for a Transformers movie. But we're definitely going to continue this Transformers franchise, of which they planned like something like 12 movies. Because overseas, It has opened to $200 million already, making 75% of its gross thus far, not in America. So we're going to have like a weird export franchise. And I haven't seen this Transformers The Last Night, but apparently what it does is allows the series to do spin-off movies that take place anywhere in the history of the Earth, because that's how long Transformers have been around. Has anybody here actually subjected themselves to Transformers The Last
Yes,
Night?
Yes, I have. And you're right.
Is there a post-credit scene?
There's not a post-credit scene, but there's an end movie tag where this takes... Do you want me to spoil it? This is a spoiler section. This
definitely
is a spoiler section. If anyone is precious about the Transformers Last Night spoilers, skip ahead to the next segment. So this takes a little build-up. What happened at the end of Age of Extinction? Optimus Prime is flying through space, right?
Right.
For some reason. Well,
he was going to return to the Cybertron?
Yeah, he wants Cybertron to be okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know what his motivation is, but he does return to Cybertron and is curious about why it's been destroyed. Turns out there's a sorceress named Quintessa. She's a robot, but she's also a sorceress. And she has taken over the Cybertron, and she's going to lead it using Optimus Prime, who she turns into Nemesis Prime. I'm not sure why she needed to wait for him. There's a staff on Earth that he is going to retrieve for her, but she can also move Cybertron to Earth because Earth is actually Unicron. That's right, the ancient enemy of Cybertron, who featured in Transformers the movie, voiced by Orson Welles in that classic 80s film. Unicron is actually Earth, and she's going to go destroy Earth using their planet. So the planet actually goes all the way to Earth. Again.
Because didn't Leonard Nimoy bring the planet to Earth in the third one?
Oh my God, is that right?
Yeah, I was just about to say, I thought that happened already.
No, it's hard to tell. There's just so many moving parts. The movies have become more and more like the actual Transformers in that there's a bazillion things going on and they're all morphing and changing position and you never know quite what's going on. And this is definitely the least comprehensible Transformers movie of the bunch. So at the end, they defeat Quintessa. They, like, blow her up. Optimus Prime and Quintessa are not in this movie very much. It's bizarre how little of the antagonists are in the, you know, I'm forgetting the main Decepticon's name.
Megatron?
Yeah, Megatron is alive, I guess. Was he Galvatron in Age of Extinction, or he's a jet or a gun right now?
Hang on. I thought we were talking about box office. How are we getting so deeply involved in the plot?
I'm about to explain. Okay. Because, okay, so I guess I don't have to talk about Megatron, but Quintessa at the end, it does not get killed. In fact, she is an actress played by, I want to get this right, she's definitely of Eastern descent, maybe. I'm not exactly sure. I have to look that up, and I don't want to be
probably Chinese, given
I would guess, I was going to say, she's probably Chinese for box office purposes, but I cannot say for sure, and I would love to get her name at some point, but I apologize to everyone listening. But she is an actress.
So wait, she turns into a human?
A human actress who in disguise, robots in disguise, and she is going to summon... So basically, Unicron lives underneath Earth and is starting to emerge when Cybertron shows up, but it never fully happens. And you get the impression that maybe she's going to make Unicron erupt out of the Earth. I don't understand what that means, and I'm not sure how it happens, but a lot of other garbage and things happen. Cade Yeager blows some stuff up. There's another woman. There's a secret society that protects Transformers. Here's where it all wraps around. You're right, Dave. The movie plants like a lot of options for spin-offs. Basically, the Transformers have been on planet Earth since the days of King Arthur. So you can now have a Transformers movie that takes place in any decade. The proposed spin-off that they want to do, the Bumblebee movie starring Edge of 17's Haley Steinfeld, is supposedly coming out next year, directed by the guy who did Kubo and the Two Strings, and probably takes place in the 80s. I don't see why they wouldn't do that, because now Bumblebee can be anywhere at any time. In fact, in Transformers The Last Night, you see Bumblebee killing Nazis during World War II. So pretty much anything can happen. And they could easily do like G.I. Joe crossover with Transformers if they wanted to, which is a thing that happened in the comics. They could do, I don't know what the fuck they want to do.
Space Knight.
But now they shouldn't do anything, right? Like, this was a bomb.
Well, here's the question.
Not overseas.
at what point does this just become like the modern equivalent of direct-to-video and we just start pumping out Transformers movies outside of our borders?
Well,
oh, man.
You would know better than anyone if that's financially plausible, because this movie definitely cost like $240 million. Well, I'm reading $217 million, but seriously, this movie looks, it might be the most expensive movie I've ever seen. Just looking at the visuals, seeing it in IMAX 3D, it was really stunning. And I would actually tell people to go see it, because I've just never seen something that looks just so crazy and like such a waste of money. Every second feels, it's ecstasy, but it's so laughably bad. I mean, you've probably seen people on Twitter joking about Anthony Hopkins and his lines readings. He tells Mark Wahlberg, he's like, "Do you want to know, dude?" and says stupid lines like that. And he has a butler named Cogman, who is also laughably bad, who sings Ludacris's "Move, Bitch" at some point. And it's it's terrible. It's terrible, but it's so expensive.
Well, it's like Michael Bay's going to leave, so you get any sort of like main box office pull just by loyalty gone the next one. Bumblebee movie in the 80s, Harry Stanfield, maybe. That sounds a little bit American. But I don't see any reason to make like a Transformers 7 and release it in the U.S. first. That just seems like at some point you could transition entirely out of this.
But isn't that what's happening with Pacific Rim?
I mean, basically. But I mean, even to more extent, because they have so many Transformers movies ready, I feel like if you start diversifying, if you don't have to put everything to the sheen of an American summer blockbuster release, then I feel like you could churn out 12 movies pretty fast if they're, you know, Transformers movies, not necessarily that have to compete with Infinity War Part 2 or what have you.
Hmm.
I mean, I think there's a way of saving money by just refocusing and realizing that the American audience is not who these movies are going to be for anymore. I'm wondering when that's going
to
happen.
But they still need to be big.
And the trick is having Paramount not become the studio that just makes direct-to-China movies, and because that's bad for their brand in general if they want to make anything else, and the studio's not in great shape otherwise.
Yeah,
and you're not also somewhere. Like you're not going to get stars in it anymore, which I guess they don't really care about, but like Mark Wahlberg's not going to do a movie that's not released in the U.S.
Although they apparently care about stars. This is the Ghost in the Shell conundrum, right? That they want Scarlett Johansson, and these actors do well. Well, Ghost in the Shell is a bad example, because that movie actually bombed overseas, too. But I don't know how you go smaller. I don't know how a Bumblebee movie set embedded in the like Americana of the 80s. Maybe it'll be Glow Wrestling.
More 80s. Well, fuck the 80s.
Fuck the 80s.
As long as it's not Michael Bay, who keeps trying to exponentially build while he moves forward in the timeline, which is how you get Cybertron coming to Earth again. I feel like if you're allowed to stop and, you know, split off into anywhere, you know, they could do like an animated in canon. Well, they're already doing an animated Cybertron movie, but they could do something else like that that doesn't have to stand up to American theatrical box office runs.
They're doing an animated.
Yeah, Katie's right in the sense that wouldn't make it. It basically makes Paramount look like a giant money laundering operation for Chinese money. So it's going to be interesting to see how they get pulled in multiple directions. They might just be forced to make crappy Transformers movies and just release little poops into the theaters every year to sweep up on whatever China gets that we don't get.
Wow. Wait, did you say they're making an animated Cybertron movie?
I believe an animated Cybertron movie's in the works.
Wow. Yeah.
Transformers everywhere.
There's a lot of stuff in this movie. There's just so much stuff. You got a lot of Transformers in the movie. You got Barricade and Nitro Zeus and Hot Rod and Squeaks. You got John Turturro.
Squeaks the racist one?
Yeah. Well, no, Squeaks is a little robot that this new girl, the new kid in the movie, who's a total ripoff of like Rey from The Force Awakens. That's another thing about last night. It's like a remix of everything that's been popular in the last 2 years. It opens with this kind of like Stranger Things gang of kids wandering through the Transformers battleground, and then you have a girl who's just like Rey, and her scenes are exactly like Rey, and then the movie's been completely reshot, so she's gone from the second half, and Mark Wahlberg and this British good-looking lady are there, and they're like running. She's running around in heels as she's saving the day. Oh, it's just so awful. John Turturro shows up again and says scrotum twice, and Josh Duhamel is there to like.
I can't believe they found
things.
A way for John Turturro to say scrotum in this franchise again.
Oh, yeah, and he says it twice. Yeah, he's bested his. Revenge
is he
of the
under
Fallen.
The robot scrotum again?
There's no visible robot scrotum in this one, sadly. But Stanley Tucci does appear as Merlin, a drunk version of Merlin, who summons a dragon Transformers with his staff. I'll leave it at that. Let's really never look back. I don't know what they're going to do, but it's going to be baffling. Because it seems like everyone's given up on this franchise, probably for good reasons. It's stupid.
Americans have, but you know... I have some faith that the rest of the world kind of knows what they're doing at this point in time.
Do you want Let's another Transformers? What will you actually see in theaters? Let's end it on that positive note.
What will I actually see in theaters?
Yeah.
I'll see a Hayley Stanfield 80s Bumblebee movie.
God damn it, yeah. So will I.
Bring it on. Yeah, I will. I do not want to see Ancient Rome Transformers or whatever the shit.
Is that one of the proposed ones? What else do we know about?
I mean, okay, so we know about the process of it, and the process of it was everybody gave a whole bunch of ideas, and those ideas were narrowed down into pitches, and those pitches were narrowed down to screenplays, and I believe they have somewhere between 12 to 17. So, like, literally, if something leaks, it probably is one of those screenplays.
Wow.
So I'm just talking about crazy shit that I've heard. But, yeah, Transformers. Who knows?
Leading up to the July 4th holiday sees the release of a new film by Edgar Wright, acclaimed director, very popular Twitter account. Edgar Wright makes films that...
Very, very popular Twitter account. Now the second thing we get to list about Edgar Wright.
I mean, it's just true. Makes mixes that he puts on his website that people seem to dig. Edgar Wright's movies... At least from where I'm standing, make people go gaga. So just wait until Baby Driver, his latest, hits theaters this week. And Dave, you and I have seen it, but Katie, I think you'll have opinions here because I'm more interested in talking about Edgar Wright as a filmmaker, maybe why people have gotten so sucked up into what he's bringing to the table as a filmmaker. If he perhaps is as interesting as people think and what he... subverts or what he doesn't, what he delivers, comfort food perhaps. What is Edgar Wright, the filmmaker? And then we'll get into Baby Driver, which I think is both the epitome of what Edgar Wright does and almost like an infantile version of what he does. I know that he's been working on this movie since he's been making movies. I think he's been going around on the press tour saying that it's taken him like 10 years to get this movie made. And this definitely feels like a young guy's movie. Dave talked about it a little on the podcast, and we'll get there. But Katie, size up Edgar Wright. What does he do that makes people so, I don't know, they love the man?
I mean, he's never made a bad movie. That is my opinion, having not seen
really?
Forever, which I'm pretty sure I don't think is bad. I mean, he has made movies his own way. He has, he's made one quote-unquote studio movie, and it was Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is a very unique movie. And that was an adaptation of a very popular property, so he's appealing to kind of the same deeply invested nerds that have loved all of his previous movies. and I don't know, his movies are clever. They are funny in a way that not many other movies are. You know what an Edgar Wright movie is. And he's built up a Twitter persona that kind of helps support this idea that he's this sui generis kind of filmmaker. His movies are likable. He is personally likable. I don't really see what there is. I mean, I get that you are building up to an Edgar Wright takedown, but I do not
I'm
see
not.
What there is not to like.
I'm definitely not, because I think Shaun of the Dead is pretty close to a masterpiece. I think it's fantastic. And Hot Fuzz is very, very funny. And Scott Pilgrim, actually, I think is good, but a lot of people like it more than me, and I'm wondering if either of you two lost your minds
that'd
for Scott
be me.
Pilgrim. Yeah, why
that'd
do you love
me.
Why do you love Scott Pilgrim?
I think it's a pretty good adaptation of a comic book, which we don't get a lot. And it has, energy that is additive to the story that I think it does a really good representation of how you read those comic books. So as a film and as a narrative, I feel like it worked in a certain way where it made the universal themes of that story very prevalent, where I think in the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World comic books. It's something you sort of settled into over time. But my, like, also, every shot's a different setup. So, like, that's amazing in its own.
Yeah, I think as kind of a series of unique action sequences tethered by, you know, one dude's emotional arc, all of those scenes are expertly directed and really inventive, and I love how they bring the kind of, like, 8-bit video game aesthetic to screen, something that the comic could only do so much. Although the comic has more subtlety in that. I like that it can just pop into frame, and we're still focused on Scott Pilgrim, the character, and I think the movie kind of overwhelms it all, but as, like, an exercise in making all of those set pieces, it's really cool. I think that's where it leaves me a little cold. I'm not that into Scott and all the rest of the characters as, like, real people. But what about The World's End? Do you like The World's End?
The World's End, it gets better, I think, the more times you watch it, because that's, like, a meticulously planned movie as well.
Yeah, that movie, like, I've only seen the one time that it came out. I love Shaun of the Dead and watched it many, many times. So I think there's a part of me that just kind of holds that up as the yardstick every time. But I mean, I think all of his movies, like we've been talking in this about kind of like nostalgia for nostalgia's sake and people who just want to reference movies that they love. And Edgar Wright's movies are deeply influenced by pop culture, but they also have these kind of bigger ideas at the heart of them. And they're not subtle. You know, World's End is about getting older and Hot Fuzz is about, you know, like small towns and police violence. And, you know, Shaun of the Dead is about taking responsibility. And like, it's all right there on the surface. But I think it's there in character. You know, say what you about Scott Pilgrim's characters, but they are, you know, they're in the service of a bigger story. And I think that's what sets the way that he kind of tosses his pop culture references and kind of zippy filmmaking. I think that's what sets it apart.
Well, that's why the
zippy
World's
filmmaking.
End. Yeah, go.
Oh, no, I think zippy filmmaking is what I'd say ties it all together. Because unlike some other, you know, pop culture directors of our lifetime, like, you know, your Quentin Tarantinos or whatnot, what Edgar Wright doesn't do is necessarily luxuriate in his time. It seems like he needs to fill everything with a trick or a gimmick or something to sort of juice the narrative that's going along. And I think, like, that sort of pacing saves Baby Driver from maybe slowing down plot-wise a little bit. Right. But, like, that's what also made me want to see his Ant-Man way back when, is because that would have been, you know, crazy, un-Marvel, which turns out not to be what they were looking for, but I feel like that would have been an interesting decision to see that particular director pick up, because he definitely wouldn't have had a, like, blue hole portal in the sky with CGI fights with a whole bunch of computer-generated things, which is where Marvel was at the time. So I'm sad that one didn't go. But his ability as a director to keep a consistent pace where I don't feel even in rewatches that anything is slack in the narrative storytelling is what makes Edgar Wright movie to me.
It's interesting. I mean, remember, everybody listening, we all have different tastes, and one man's trash is another man's treasure. And hearing you talk about the zippiness and, like, filling every frame and making sure things don't slow down, it's kind of the negative for me of The World's End, which kind of keeps zipping off to a new, in this case, bar, they're on a bar crawl, or going to a new set piece, or going to a new revelation about this sci-fi story, as opposed to, like, really letting all these sad moments sink in. And again, I have not seen the film since 2013.
Like a Rachel getting married of Edgar Wright?
I mean, I kind of want that, right? Like, this seems like a very real experience for them. It was coming from Simon and Edgar's experience, I assume with more of Simon, Peg. But it just... It didn't seem like it really wanted to reckon with everything that was on the table and all these problems that Gary, the main character, has as a kind of abusive personality and a heavy drinker. And it gets to the twist and the gimmick, as you say, too quickly. And this leads me to Baby Driver, which for all of its pizzazz and all of its cool, that seems to be the goal. To make this movie that's indebted to, you know, Walter Hill, Driver, heist movies, and movies that are heavy with the soundtrack, this era of movie cool that Edgar Wright wants to summon, that's the whole movie. And it's this gimmick that he can't wield in an emotional way. And it doesn't have to be realistic on a, like, at a logistical level. It's very much a fantasy film, but it doesn't feel human in any way to me. It left me extremely cold because the whole mission is this is cool and we're going to move from cool thing to cool thing to cool thing to cool thing the entire time. But I'm probably getting ahead of myself. Dave, remind us what Baby Driver is about.
So Baby Driver is about a driver for bank hitmen, played by Ansel Elgort, who's named Baby, who because of a childhood accident has tinnitus in his ears. She has a ringing. He likes to drown it out with music. So he listens to music while he's doing these crime driving things. He works for Kevin Spacey, who plays a character named Doc. And Doc brings in other criminals to form bank robbing teams that Baby drives for. Baby owes Doc some money that he's paying back. And as we pick up Baby Driver, we see him, you know, do his job or get his assignment for his job. It's going to be, you know, his last job. And of, you know, anybody who's ever seen a young man accidentally involved with organized crime movie knows that it's absolutely not going to be his last job. And things complicate from there.
That's the key. Whoever's seen this movie will know what to expect from this movie, but in like a pleasurable way.
Quentin Tarantino like?
Yeah.
Well, when have you ever seen something where someone's been like, it's my last day on the job and not know what's going to happen and then want to see what's going to happen anyway?
You do. It's playing with tropes. It's juggling tropes like beanbags or something. It's having a ball with what your expectations about movies. But for me, and it speaks to a larger point, Katie, you kind of alluded to it earlier when we were knocking Amblin movies, but we're in this moment.
No, knocking Amblin movie homages. Homages. Amblin movies themselves are fine.
But this is homage in some way. This is taking the tropes that we know and subverting them and casting new fresh faces in roles that might be against type or leaning into type and, you know, mixing it all together with this incredible back, you know, wall-to-wall soundtrack. But when you take these movies that you love so much and just make more movies about them, don't they need a core of humanity? Don't they need something beyond what the experience of movies has offered us? I feel like Edgar Wright in this movie is itching his worst scratching his worst itch, which is like, I just want to make movies based on the movies that I love. And I don't think Tarantino actually does that. I think what Tarantino does so well is takes what he loves and applies it to real human people in different walks of life and personality types that we see in the real world and slaps them into genre movies. Do you disagree?
The Tarantino comparison is I can't name like a person in The Hateful Eight who feels like a real character to me.
But the
I just think like maybe if you're painting with stereotypes, I think that my point stands. I'm trying to see it from your point of view, and I more meant it in like in terms of when you go see a Tarantino movie, you go see an Edgar Wright movie, you're expecting them to set up the pins and knock them down, and the execution of that in a way that is also beautiful is, I feel like, what we're going for. Like, I don't know if I went to Kill Bill necessarily, you know, like, I don't know if I left Kill Bill raring for part two so I get to see the moment that she killed Bill, you know, like I left Kill Bill being like, he set up all these samurai and ninja movie references and, you know, house brawl references and gave me a narrative with them. It'd be weird for me to say that Baby Driver needed to have a more coherent story at the center of it, because it is just...
But Kill Bill like does offer you a coherent story. It's the story of a mother and a daughter, and I think Volume 2 becomes more powerful because the veneer of the genre exercise starts to fall away when it becomes more and more personal for her. And of course, the ending has an extravagant death for Bill, but it's still like their conversation as former lovers, as the father and mother of this child. And that is a really emotional part of that movie. And that's what I think something like Baby Driver is missing, and something that I think comparable movies to Baby Driver might be La La Land, or actually this is going to – no one has seen this movie, but Book of Henry is like this, except Book of Henry is completely off the rails and much, much worse, The Baby Driver, in an exercise to like replicate. If Colin Trevorrow only understands emotion on the terms of movies, he has created a diabolical experiment in taking what you know about tropes and trying to subvert them, to just pull all of the strings in your brain and pull the levers and make emotions happen. You know, he knows how movies are constructed. He knows how movies work on you, and he's going to use Book of Henry against you by having a mother kill their neighbor or tell a son die of a brain tumor, and then blah, blah, blah. It's all movie gears turning. And Baby Driver is kind of the same way, in that we know all the tropes, as Katie mentioned, but now it's going to be the slight twist. We're going to inject the music in, and it's going to be hyper cool all the time. Like, is Ansel Elgort's baby a real person? Does he feel real emotion? He's supposed to have this romance, but is there any basis for it other than he actually dreams at certain points of the movie of this kind of like classic 1950s, you know, dream world that he would like to be living in with his, you know, object of his affection, Deborah, played by Lily James. He dreams of that, except his real world is also a dream world where he's like dancing around with his iPod. And oh my God, Ansel Elgort. What movie were we introduced to Ansel Elgort in?
Fault in Our Stars.
Fault in Our Stars. Right.
Big movie.
He's not cool. I'm sorry. The big problem with Baby Driver is that this whole movie is predicated on Edgar Wright. This is going to sound so obnoxious, but like the movie is pretentious in like a classic way, which is the music is supposed to be cool and Ansel Elgort's baby is supposed to be cool and everything is supposed to be cool because movies tell us these things are cool. But if it's actually, if the calculus is not cool, then it's not going to add up and it's not going to be cool. That's a problem. And that's what
I feel like
regurgitating movies is a problem.
I feel like you have a lot of good points to make about Baby Driver, but I feel like if you were to apply those points to other films, it might be like a little off. I don't know. Katie, is what we want from white male directors complete unpredictability, or if you find a way to do something good, do you just keep doing that because it's a business?
Listen, I just want to go back and defend the emotional quality in Edgar Wright's other movies. I mean, as I said, I've seen Shaun of the Dead a bunch of times, and that movie has real feelings in it. The way the
it really
reason
does.
It works is you've got the Simon Pegg, Nick Frost friendship at the center, but you've got the stepdad played by Bill Nighy and kind of the way that that relationship changes over the course of the film. And Space, the TV show they all worked on before that, did an amazing job with that as well. So I think regardless of what Baby Driver does or does not accomplish, I think saying that Edgar Wright doesn't play with character or real feelings in his career is not true.
Oh, I didn't want to make a broad statement like that. I actually think Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End take a similar tactic, which is like, here's how movies work. But what if the movie starred us? Friends! And like, that's interesting, right? The World's End is about a real problem that these guys faced, and they injected it into an Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where Shaun of the Dead is really those guys sitting around trying to be better people or trying to get their life in order, but they're also in a zombie movie. Baby Driver is a cool guy character from one movie in another cool guy heist movie that's also a cool guy romance movie that's also a cool guy musical. And without a human component, I think that's where it falters. And what Edgar Wright's movies do when they're the best is humanize genre for people. Does that make sense?
I mean, Dave, to answer your question from earlier, like, I think you do want people to stay in their lane to some extent. You want people to tell the stories that they're capable of telling. For white men, their lane is almost basically everything, so they can expand a lot. but I do get how, you know, with someone like Edgar Wright, who has shown such a clear grasp of film and knowing what movies do and don't do, and you kind of do want him to see, do you want to see him play with every genre or not play with genre at all and make something different, which is why I also hate that we never got to see his Ant-Man. I don't know. It sounds like Baby Driver is something different, and maybe your mileage varies on how successful it was for him to kind of try something new.
Well, also, this is a good project to have after everything that happened with Ant-Man, because if he would have come out with something that wasn't 100% Edgar Wright, our think piece would be, is Edgar Wright gone? You know, are we never getting that director back because the studio like poisoned him? Like, if Baby Driver didn't work out, especially after he talked it up as being like this project that he'd been working on since he'd been like even working on Spaced, you could see that if you watch a lot of Edgar Wright movies. You could see that he had some of these ideas earlier on, and it's taken him a while to refine it. But when it does get to the point, like the opening title dance sequence that Patches was talking about, where he's listening to music and the lyrics are actually written on parts of the scenery
as
that
like
you
graffiti.
Pan over while the lyrics come on. I think I like leaned over to the person next to me and just said like, shit, because like that's a well constructed something. And at that point, I was just in awe that I was watching the movie. I guess I can't knock that Baby isn't the most compelling main character, but I kind of think here he's just supposed to be a void because he is playing off all these scenery chewers and is basically just our motivation for having a soundtrack. I don't think it's a bad thing for an adventure movie that takes place in the summer. I don't know. I think this is excellently placed a time for release, and I think it's a nice little injection in sequel summer to have Baby Driver come along and kick people in the nuts. I don't know if it's going to be my favorite Edgar Wright movie for ever. Well, but we'll see.
But it's your favorite now?
No, it's still behind Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
Better than Shaun of the Dead. Interesting. Well, there are highlights of this movie. Like Kevin Spacey is really funny. I think Jamie Foxx is very funny, even though his character is like totally convoluted and, you know, a cool as ice ringleader in one scene and then like a psychopath later in the movie. It's kind of bizarre, but I think Edgar Wright should make a movie with Jamie Foxx because Jamie Foxx can sling Edgar Wright's words and it's very funny. And John Hamm is another like crazy person, totally sporting the Val Kilmer Heat haircut to a tee later in the movie. I mean, the second half of Baby Driver is Heat. I don't think that's a spoiler. It's just very, very apparent. But that's where it kind of like got bogged down for me. This movie has its own soul, or at least a musical one, that should be kind of whisking it in so many different directions that when it gets bogged down in referencing other stuff, it doesn't seem to be moving at the pace of its own soundtrack because it's like so many references in one movie. I don't know. It's definitely a passion project, but I think the passion is staring at its navel a little bit. That's so rude. But
yeah, you're being really rude to this. What I'm sure is going to be very well publicly enjoyed movie.
It really is. It really will be. I'm going to be on an island on this one. I understand, but it's just really struck me, and I think it may have to do with back to back Book of Henry, Baby Driver, more than me seeing a lot of people like this movie. That's not how I act.
I think that might be it because I had a lot of trouble not comparing it to Atomic Blonde, which I think is really manipulative with the way that it uses its music, but we'll also get there. But I think, yes, Baby Driver tends to absorb whatever it's next to, so maybe it'll be interesting. Go see Transformers The Last Night, then go see Baby Driver, and then tell us what you think Baby Driver was about and what the planet's made of.
That does it for this week's Writing in the War Room. We'll be back next week, and I believe with David, freshly returned from Japan, provided he wants to come back to this country. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com.
Cam.
And I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, you can leave some comments, we'll read them here, or you can leave your made-up Baby Driver soundtrack. I would take your... it's a good soundtrack. It's got some deep cuts. Give us some more.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, and this week you could find me on Thrillist, where I scoured the internet. No, I just scoured YouTube, thank God, because otherwise I could have broken some laws for the most shocking videos I could find. You should definitely check that out. Otherwise, you could find the rest of us on Facebook at our fightinginthewarroom.com Facebook page, where some of you have been joining up there, leaving comments on our episode. We appreciate it and read them.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where I've been writing a little bit more lately. And I think I plugged my Zach Woods conversation last week, but it was really good. And the Silicon Valley finale was good, and you should read it.
It was really good. Your piece was very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good. Did anybody catch the newsy, gossipy dig in it?
Oh, Pat just tweeted it, I believe.
I did. I wanted to expose that.
Yeah, well, but then TJ Miller like really kind of laid it out in that Hollywood Reporter article, so... He beat me to it.
Sounds
weird
vicious.
Drama behind the scenes of that show. Anyway, find me at VanityFair.com. We're on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where, as always, we'd love to hear from you, where you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Baby Driver and the only living boy in New York, what Simon and Garfunkel song should be a summer movie next year?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.